helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel. What are your rights worth? What would it take for you to give up your liberty? Now, most people I talk to say they place a very high value on things like freedom, liberty, and their rights. But I wonder, do our actions match our rhetoric? See, it's one thing when government pays you for the rights they infringe on, either with cash or with services. But what about when they simply walk up and take it? Now, those in government often claim they do this because it is necessary. But as William Pitt the Younger once said, necessity is a plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. So I ask you, are you following the creed of slaves, or will you stand up and defend your rights? Well, hello there, everyday Americans. Paul Engel here with the Constitution Study. I am still on the road. I'm actually recording this episode from Boise, Idaho. My first time ever in Idaho, and here I am in Boise. And a little inside baseball, I'm sitting in a hotel room that is very echoey. So I've actually got pillows and blankets around me trying to muffle some of the echo. So this sounds good because I want to give you a good product. Now, what got me started on this particular thought for the day is that quote from William Pitt the Younger. And looking at just how often government says they must do something, that it is necessary. Well, for example, the National Transportation Safety Board just said that all new vehicles need alcohol detection devices that can stop motorists from driving while drunk. So let's think about this for a second. The NTSB, again, an agency that does not legally exist because, well, you're exercising a power not delegated to the United States. And they've been, and I've talked about this before, they are pushing for a new law that would require every new vehicle have an alcohol detector. Now, I'm not for drunk driving. It is dangerous. It's dangerous to others. But is this the way to do it? Is the way to deal with drunk driving to get first the federal government, which is not in charge of transportation, except as part of interstate commerce, to get them to order, that's right, order car manufacturers to put alcohol detectors in all new vehicles? Why are we punishing the innocent for the acts of the guilty? Now, we have to take responsibility for our actions. It is not necessary that you prove that you are not intoxicated before you operate a vehicle. What is necessary is for the government to punish those who do. It's cleaner and simple. But you see, that's not the way government thinks these days. They think it is, if it's a good idea, it is necessary that they require this. It's just one more infringement on your rights. No, not the right to drive drunk, but the right to operate your property without unnecessary government interference. Now, while drunk driving does harm other people, and to have a law against it is perfectly legitimate, requiring the federal government mandating, dictating, ordering, acting like petty tyrants saying the best way to deal with this, in our opinion, is to put alcohol detectors in all new vehicles, and apparently the American people are just too stupid to require it themselves. That's basically what they say. That's the meaning behind what they say. Now, apparently what instigated this was a 2021 automobile crash in California, where 9 people, including 7 children, were killed. And it's a terrible tragedy, especially for that family. But according to the NTSB, that's what prompted this call for alcohol impairment detection systems. But tell me, is that the only way? Is that the best way to deal with such a situation? I mean, I've been around long enough. We've spent decades trying to get people to stop driving drunk. And really, how long do you think it will be before people figure out a way to bypass these systems? See, because part of the problem is it has to be, they initially want it to be a passive system, but it has to not give you false positives. Just imagine You go to work in the morning, you get in your car, and it won't start because, well, the quote-unquote passive alcohol detection system malfunctions. Who knows what it is? For whatever reason, it malfunctions, and you can't get to work. And they say, well, if it saves just one life, really? There's a lot of things that we don't do, even though it would save just one life. We don't have a 5-mile-an-hour national speed limit. Just think all the lives that would save. No, this is about, you know, again, somebody in a bureaucracy that has gotten too big for their britches thinks they know better than you how you should live your life, and they act like you're just too stupid to decide that you won't do it for yourself. You're too stupid to do it for yourself, so we must do it for you. Otherwise, it wouldn't simply be the NTSB recommending people get alcohol detection systems. They're requiring it whether you want it or not, whether you have a history of drunk driving or not. So in other words, we're going to take the hundreds of millions of vehicles sold, and we're going to put a quote-unquote safety mechanism in, even though that'll only help, what, thousands, hundreds of thousands? It truly is this idea of the nanny state. We're going to tell you how to live your life. And of course, it's not just drunk driving. The Department of Homeland Security, they've got a new electric vehicle program. You know, we've got all of this push for EVs, electric vehicles, because, well, we know that the globe is warming, even though it is barely perceptible, even though it's not nearly as hot as it was in the past. No, we have to do something. And the only answer is electric vehicles. So they say they're touting they've got a system. They're going to be buying electric vehicles for the border. You know what they don't have at the border? Charging stations. See, the funny thing is they're these things. They've got these fast charging stations, and supposedly that they can charge a vehicle to 80% of the capacity in just 30 minutes to an hour. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to imagine you're sitting there, you're a landowner near the border, and you spot a group of illegal migrants. In fact, you think there may even be terrorists. So you call DHS and you say, hey, there are people and they're ransacking my land and they're doing all this damage. And they said, oh, we'll be out there as soon as we charge up our batteries. Now, again, I have no inherent problem with electric vehicles. There's a lot of situations where electric vehicles make sense in dense urban areas or the suburban areas around them where you're driving relatively short distances. You've got a lot of congestion. You have issues like smog and exhaust and whatnot. But the idea of we're going to put these electric vehicles where we don't have the capacity to charge them, because we want to, what, look good? We want to appear green? Forgetting all the mining that goes into getting the minerals necessary to build those batteries. And where are they getting the power for the charging stations? Oh, yeah, they're going to have to run power to the charging stations. Now, maybe they'll put in some solar chargers. And, of course, then you got to mine the minerals for the chargers. And you've got to get the minerals for the batteries, and someone's got to maintain all of that. To me, this doesn't seem like the smartest place to start such an endeavor. Maybe if the federal government would get out of the way and let industry find better ways of doing these things, we could find a solution other than electric vehicles, or maybe just a better way to charge the electric vehicles, better battery technology. If we didn't have the government keep telling us, no, this is the way you must go, it is necessary that you follow this path because we've decided that's the correct answer. Of course, we've heard that before, haven't we? You remember when the FDA came along and said, we've got to approve these measures, these jabs, because, well, it's an emergency. We've got our emergency use authorization. We've got to do something for COVID. Forget the testing. Darn the testing. Full speed ahead. Yeah, well, now the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Health and Human Services, they released a report and they concluded that the FDA overused its emergency use authorization during the scamdemic. Now they looked at the IG looked at the way FDA adopted the process during the scamdemic, and they found that the FDA expanded allowances for EUA based on faulty data, faulty tests, in contradiction to things like science. Remember when Fauci said that he was a scientist? You disagree with him? What about the fact that as I said, there was insufficient safety testing, that they never actually did a true safety testing. They ignored the fact that there was at first anecdotal and then study showing that we had treatments, meaning there wasn't they didn't meet the legal requirement for an emergency use authorization. Yeah, all that because we were told, well, it was necessary. We have to do something, and we have to do something now. Act in haste, repent at leisure. Now, there have been plenty of people talking lately about we have to do something about big tech censorship and media censorship, and we have to do something. So the Senate Judiciary Committee, right on top of the ball, they advanced a proposal at their September 26th meeting that would allow those corporate media outlets that have been censoring data and claiming that stuff that is actually true is misinformation, even after it's been proven to be true. Yeah, they want those same media cartels to form more cartels with big tech platforms to further infringe on your right to freedom of speech. Now, this one I find a bit interesting because, as I've said many, many times, these private organizations have the right to determine what content is on their platform. When you talk about, you know, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, as private entities, they have the right to control their property, including their platform. But here we have the federal government. Oh, by the way, I've said similar things about the corporate media. But here we have the federal government trying to find out ways for these two groups to better collude. And I find it, as usual, right, if you want to know what the purpose of what the effect of a bill is, well, just assume it's the opposite of its name. See, this legislation is dubbed the Journalism Competition and Preservation Act. You know, I look at the Constitution, and it says nothing about the federal government preserving journalism. What it does say is that Congress cannot pass a law that infringes on your right to freedom of speech or freedom of the press. So if what they're trying to do is allow the big tech companies like Facebook, Google, and Twitter to negotiate with media companies about access to content and the distribution of content, I don't think that's a law increasing your freedom of speech. It does seem to me like it's a law designed to infringe on your freedom of speech. There's a lot going on here, and I'm sure we'll find out more as time goes on. But just think, there are, four stories where the government has said it is necessary for us to tell you how to live your life, to tell you that you're assumed drunk until proven sober, that we must move to electric vehicles even though we don't have the infrastructure to support them, that the FDA, which told us we have to rush through these medications, but we're now finding out that they're dangerous and not effective. And now we have the Senate Judiciary Committee saying we must encourage these organizations to work together because they've been so good at denying free speech. Does it sound like it's what they're talking about is necessary for you? Or does it sound like it's something that they think is necessary for them? When is necessary to infringe on your rights? See, there's an interesting thing. Liberty is defined by, or civil liberty is defined by Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary. Basically paraphrasing, it is the right to live your life as you see fit without unnecessary external influence. So let me ask you, are any of these measures actually necessary? Now, before I take my break, I want to remind you, I have been on the road for more than a week. And I have to tell you, it's dragging. It's a long days, strange beds, little sleep. And, you know, I get to go show up at these events. And people are expecting me to, well, to give a good talk, to be informative, maybe a little funny. And it's not easy when you've been on the road for 6, 8, 10 hours to do that. But one of the things I use to help is Focus and Recall from HealthyCell.com. It is wonderful whether I'm driving or I'm speaking or I'm just preparing to do another podcast, another radio episode with you, to have this in my backpack so I can take this in about 10, 15 minutes. I'm awake. I'm alert. I can focus. I can do the work that you all expect me to do. You're not out there going, oh, poor Paul, boo-hoo, he's on the road and he's tired. No, you want a good product, and so do the people I'm talking to. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you can get 25% off your first order at HealthyCell.com, whether you use Focus and Recall or any of their other products. Just go to the website. Again, that's HealthyCell.com. Use the code OUTLOUD at checkout, and they'll give you 25% off your first order. So check it out. They've got wonderful. They got the Focus and Recall, REM Sleep, the Immune Super Boost. I use them all to help get me through this particular time. Now, just don't forget, use the code OUTLOUD at checkout. It lets them know you're an America Out Loud listener, and they'll give you 25% off your first order. So give it a try, and we'll be right back after this break.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. The digital age is narrowing our attention span. Trouble concentrating or recalling information is frustrating, embarrassing, and kills productivity. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created Focus and Recall to boost your brain power. Unlike other supplements that don't work, Focus and Recall is not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science backed ingredients to help you immediately sharpen focus, concentrate longer, and strengthen recall. These physician-formulated gels come in a small gel pack. Tear off the top, shoot it down, or mix it in water. Over 1,000 reviews with an average star rating of over 4.5 proves it works. Supercharge your brain and see the difference. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order, risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD. That's HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
Oral hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years, but our diet and the way we eat has, creating an environment in your mouth for bacteria to wreak havoc on your teeth and gums. For better oral health, get Spry Dental Defense, an oral care line designed to combat acid-creating bacteria. The toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and gum all contain xylitol, a natural ingredient shown to dramatically improve oral health. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural retailers.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution and teach rising generation to be free. And today we're talking about this idea of necessity as an excuse to infringe on our rights. Just the way William Pitt the Younger warned us about so many years ago. We talked in the first segment about some examples of government saying, well, we have to do this for you because it's necessary. But there's more. And it isn't always a state issue. I mean, a federal issue. Sometimes it's a state issue. For example, we've been hearing a lot about the necessity to affirm the mental disease known as transgenderism. Yeah, I know. People keep telling me it's a physical disease. It's a mental disease. It's the idea that you're confused between your body and what your mind thinks about it. And of course, we're all being told that we have to affirm all of them because, well, if you don't affirm a transgender person, they'll just go out and kill themselves. Now, right now, Michigan is kind of getting it from all directions because they've been caught encouraging their teachers to quote-unquote transition children to new genders without consent or even knowledge of the parents. See, they're taking this idea that is necessary to do this to a whole new level. Just imagine you have a child in school, and you find out that not only is the school, our teaching school, encouraging that they go forth with these body-altering treatments, whether it's hormones or puberty blockers or actual transition surgery, these are treatments that have a long-term effect, something that you cannot undo. And not only are they doing it, they're doing it behind your back. They're not getting your permission. They're not even getting your, they're not letting you know it's happening. And yet you are going to have to deal with a lot of the consequences, not just mental, but physical. Imagine going to a doctor's visit. Your child is having, say, maybe a bad reaction or some complication from some of this treatment. And you don't know that they're on these drugs. These powerful drugs that that mess with their body chemistry. So you can't tell the doctor. So they don't know to take that in consideration when they're considering treatment. Or you don't know that your child had some surgery, only to find out later. And again, now that's too late. Now your chance at grandchildren from that child are gone. Your child is basically now stuck in a situation that studies have shown doesn't come out well, that these transitions don't lead to lower suicides. They don't lead to better outcomes because they're fixing the wrong problem. But you see, we're being told by the quote-unquote experts that this is necessary. We have to do this because, well, we know better than you do. And, you know, how dare you question how we want to treat your children. And of course, it's not just transgender. We are sexualizing our children to a tremendous extent. Yeah, I remember when we were in school, there was a big debate about sex education and the idea of making sure that young adults, people, adolescents, were taught about what was happening to their bodies and how to... what they were referred to as safe sex. I grew up right at the beginning of the AIDS scare, and there was a lot of discussion about making sure that you knew how to have safe sex and all of that. But it's getting beyond outrageous. The Manhattan Institute fellow Christopher Ruffo, he's kind of shined a light on some of this information. You see, there's a website promoted by the National Education Association, one of the country's largest teachers' unions. And, I can't describe what is in this, was on this website, that the NEA is promoting to teachers to promote to children. I can't describe it because it's foul. It's not simply talking about sex. It's talking about perverted sex. It's talking about things that are just damaging to the human body. But you see, that's what's being promoted to your children. It's one of the reasons why I am so glad we did not send my daughter to public school, to a government-run school, to have her exposed to this. You know, I remember when I was a child, one of the concerns with sex education was what happened when you expose children to things that they may not have been thinking about. You're encouraging them to a certain extent to try these things, or that was part of the argument, right? Children who maybe were not ready, maybe were not thinking about this, would now be exposed to this idea and they become curious. I know there's a balancing act, but part of the problem in my mind is who knows best when it's time to talk to your children about sex? Is it you or is it the government? Because remember, public schools, public teachers, these are government employees. And the idea that the government not only wants to talk to a child about sex, but wants to talk about truly, I mean, pornographic, nasty. I don't even want to look at it. I don't even want to look at the names. And then I say it's necessary. It's necessary that we not only expose our children to the facts, the biology of what happens as they go through puberty, of the ways to keep themselves safe and healthy during sex, but we have to expose them to perversion, to pornography. I mean, put it this way. If I were to walk up to our school board meeting and I were to start describing just the titles of what Mr. Rufo has tweeted about, I might be arrested for the foul language. I mean, it's stuff you wouldn't have in polite public. Now, what can we do about this? Well, there are some parents that in Ohio, they have an idea. They are threatening a school district with a federal lawsuit for hiding quote-unquote, transitioning students. You see, parents of students at Hillard City School, they have questions. They want to know if they'll be made aware of gender and sex-related conversations between the students, the school, and the staff. They want to know if there's a political activism going on inside the school stirred up by one of these LGBT organizations. And they've given the school until October 17th to answer these questions or be targeted with a federal lawsuit. Now, I don't know that I like the idea of them going straight to the federal government for this, right? Because I think they might do better off starting at the state, even county courts. I'm not familiar with the Constitution of the state of Ohio or all of its laws, but you know what? It might be better to start local. I fully endorse, you know, going local first, the idea that not everything is a federal case. But I do kind of understand why they would go that way, because let's face it, which would scare the school more, a lawsuit in county court or in federal court? But what I find interesting is they're prepared to go to court to get answers about what the school is doing with their children. And again, we come back to this whole scenario. Well, we have to talk to about it. It's necessary. If the parents don't do it, we have to do it because it's necessary. How about the parents don't do it because they don't think their child is ready? How about the fact that the child is not property of the state? It is not property of the school district. And just because you went to school and you got a degree doesn't mean you're an expert in the child. In fact, based on what I've learned about some of the things our teachers are being taught, I would say you're not qualified to teach a child, which really is sad. I have great memories of some of my teachers in school, everywhere from elementary school up through middle school and high school. I have memories of men and women that were dedicated to teaching the children. Not yet. Some of them, not so much. But I can think of, from my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Clark, who designed her classroom in a way different from everybody else, so that the children could, of which I was one, could get the best education. But I could not even conceive of her hiding from my parents what discussions she would be having with me. Or maybe my middle school, a middle school teacher I had, who we used to joke a lot, and you know, we would swap puns and jokes, but never would I would he hide something from my parents. It's anathema to what a teacher was in those days. But here we have teachers saying, nope, we know better. We know it is necessary that we teach this, and if you aren't okay with that, well, that's too bad. Which leads me to some legislation being proposed by Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. See, he wants to cut off funds from public schools, both elementary and middle schools, that do not obtain parental consent before addressing a student by a different pronoun. Now, this gets into that whole transgender nonsense, the transgender mental situation. But of this, I'm kind, you know, I have mixed emotions. On the one hand, I am all for making sure that parents are aware of what's going on with their children, especially in elementary and middle schools. As they get to high school, most children are gaining more and more independence. So, but he's focusing on a segment of our student population that truly is being exposed to dangerous ideas. But he's doing it with federal funds, which shouldn't be being sent to those schools in the first place. In other words, Senator Scott would not have the ability to cut off federal funds if the Senate actually followed the Constitution, says we don't have the authority to spend money on education. If Congress was involved, if Congress followed the Constitution, then we wouldn't have the federal money for him to play with. But then again, we wouldn't have the federal government getting involved in setting standards for teacher education either. If we actually had local control of our schools, if these truly were public schools, not government schools, and I make a distinction. See, a public school is controlled at the local level. There's a school board that is overseen by the parents. They work together to come up with the standards and curriculum. That is a public school. We don't have public schools anymore. We have government schools. Now, I don't know if we had public schools when I was a child. I wasn't paying attention. But I know we don't have them now. So on the one hand, I do cheer Senator Scott for this attempt to use the power of the purse, even though he's been bribing the schools with federal money, saying, we're going to cut you off if you take the parents out of the equation, at least when it comes to elementary and middle schools, and when you're talking about pronouns. I'm still unhappy that he has that power to begin with, because the federal government is acting so unconstitutionally. So this segment, I focus a bit on the transgender and other sexual issues. And it keeps coming back to me what I was told when I was a student in high school, that, you know, we had to have sex education because this information was so necessary, it couldn't be left up to the parents. That there would be parents who didn't tell the children what they needed to know, and then they could get in trouble. In my day, that meant getting pregnant. As I was going through high school, of course, we started having the AIDS scare. And I actually worked on a computer program for an educational bus to teach children about, teach high school students about AIDS and how to protect themselves. But I keep coming back to, was it necessary? Was it necessary that the government decides what is and isn't appropriate? That the government decides what is the best age and completely ignores the individuality of the child? It's what drives me nuts. You know, I've said this story before and I'm using it more often, but when I was a child, my grandparents had a house with a facade of stones that we took out of the creek. Each one was unique. Each one was different. You had to find the right spot so that it would fit in together. But now, for decades, we treat children as if they're bricks, if they're all exactly the same. That every child at this age is ready for this level of school. That every child at this age is not only ready for this type of discussion, but they have to be ready. If they're not ready, then there's something wrong. And it really has, I think, been very detrimental to our young people, to our students, to our children, and by extension, to our society. I mean, I think about the hyper-sexualized society we live in, where you're seeing middle-aged moms trying to dress like teenage sluts. There's been a long-term impact on this idea that it was necessary to sexualize our children at a younger and younger and younger age, and ignore the fact that, well, some children at a young age may be mentally prepared for that, others are not. It truly is sad. It truly disturbs me that in this day and age, we let sex override everything. We forget about true. We forget about good. It seems if somebody mentions sex, we have to not only allow it, we have to endorse it. And that turns us into a rather perverted generation, which I guess isn't too much of a surprise. We act more and more like the Roman Empire, which sadly means we may end up closer and closer to the ultimate outcome of the Roman Empire. And I think we the people have let it happen because we let those in government tell us it was necessary that we do this. We trusted the experts even when the experts got it wrong. Even when the experts, what the experts said didn't make any sense. Well, then all they did was hide it from us, and now we're reaping that whirlwind. And whether it be a question of homosexuality, transsexuality, or just sexuality in general, we've been told it was necessary and it has led us to a very dark and dismal point in our lives, point in the history of America. Now, I have to take another break, but before I do, I want to remind you, you know, you can find not only my voice, but a lot of voices and articles and stuff on AmericaOutloud.com. There are plenty of content creators giving you good information from different points of view. It's a great place to go every day to get to find out about what's going on, the news, the happenings, and more importantly, to actually share that information. Find the stories, the articles, the podcasts, the videos that you find interesting and share them with friends and family. That is how we secure the blessings of liberty. Not by deciding what is necessary for other people to see, but by exposing them to these different ideas.
All right, you've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution study. Today, we're talking about necessity. And I want to close out this episode with what happens when we focus on necessity, when we make things a necessity. You see, the reason I believe William Pitt the Younger said necessity is a plea for every infringement of human freedom is because necessity justifies doing what's wrong. Let me explain this. Back in the 2020 election, there were people who thought it was absolutely necessary. The future of the country would be decided based on whether or not Donald Trump won the election. And because they viewed it as a necessity, as an existential threat to democracy, as they call it, even though we're not a democracy, I believe there are people that went too far. They would do things that otherwise they wouldn't consider because they thought the outcome was worth it, that it was a necessity. Now, probably one of the most egregious examples of this were the actions of Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his wife. The fact that they were willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to influence the election and to do so in a way toward that supported the Democratic Party, I think is an example of the belief that you are right and the necessity of being so. The necessity of getting the outcome that you think is the best one. So you can justify doing a lot of things because it's necessary. For example, most people would believe taking another human life is a terrible thing. It's a tragic thing. But if that life is an imminent threat to your own, well, it becomes justified because it's a necessity to save your own life. I'm not equating an election with the need to save a person, someone's own life. But if you're willing to spend almost $500 million just to help get the outcome in an election that you want, that tells me a lot. It tells me you viewed your political opponent or a political opponent as such an existential inherent threat that it was worth $500 million, almost $500 million, to do everything you could to make sure they didn't win. And for those of you who don't know about the Zuckerberg scandal, Zuckerberg gave, it was like $470 or $430 million to an organization that basically went around and gave money to county election boards for voter registration and, you know, and get out the vote drives. But they focused on Democratic strongholds. In other words, most of the money went to, they went to swing states and they went to the democratically advantageous districts that are tend to be more Democrat than Republican. And again, I fully believe that the Zuckerbergs believed that it was necessary to push the envelope in order to get the outcome they wanted. And by doing so, just think of the millions of Americans, at least hundreds of thousands, millions of Americans, that they said, your choice is the wrong one. It's necessary that we override your will, your desire, in order to get the one that we think is right. Which, if you think about it, it really does say a lot, because they're saying that the Republic doesn't work, that people cannot be allowed to choose their representatives without, well, their external influence, because they're making the wrong choices. That's arrogance. And now, the fact that he has, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to throw away at this is not my problem. But when you do so in such an obviously partisan manner, that is a problem. Well, there's right now there are groups, including the Center for Renewing America, that have filed complaints against the Zuckerbergs and the groups they created, the Center for Tech and Civic Life and the Center for Election Innovation and Research. And another one I hadn't heard of before, the National Vote at Home Institute, is claiming that the tax breaks these organizations got as a not-for-profit were invalid. At least that's the way I understand it, because they were partisan and get-out-the-vote, you know, not-for-profit, get-out-the-vote campaigns are not allowed to be partisan. But when you give the money in 80-90% towards Democratic districts, as opposed to ignoring the Republican districts, that's a partisan organization. Does it change the outcome of the election? No, nothing's going to change the outcome of the election. At best, the Zuckerbergs will have to pay probably tens of million dollars in taxes. You know, these organizations will have to pay probably, you know, who knows, maybe tens of millions of dollars in taxes and fines. And the Zuckerbergs have the money, so I'm sure they will help them out. But to me, this is an example of allowing your understanding of necessity to overrule justice. forget fairness. Let's just talk plain justice. If the people are not the ones choosing the electors, if they're being manipulated in that choice, then we're no longer a republic. We're not even a democracy. I don't know if we still qualify as third world or banana republic. We are an oligarchy where those with money use that money to control elections and by that control policy. Well, another example has been the recent spate of censorship referred to as misinformation. Now, let's face it. None of us want information we disagree with to be spread far and wide. We want our information we agree with, to be spread. But again, if we are fair, if we are just, if we put justice above our opinion, well, then we let the other side speak. I love letting the other side speak because it's so often that they show themselves to be so foolish. But we have a big tech, a high tech, a media society that doesn't believe there's information you should not be allowed to see, allowed to hear, not based on its accuracy, but based on their opinion of its accuracy. See, that's always been the issue. They talk about misinformation, but who decides what is and is not misinformation? Well, at the moment, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin is he's asking Twitter's general manager, Jay Sullivan, to testify before the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee just to discuss how COVID went about setting up their COVID misinformation policy. You know, information like the jab would stop the spread of COVID. Wasn't designed to. That the jab would not spread throughout your body. Wasn't designed to. That ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine were dangerous drugs that shouldn't be allowed to be even tried, even in the most desperate of situations. Now, all these are factually incorrect, but they were labeled misinformation by Twitter, and if not actually taken off their platform, certainly deprioritized. Now, listen, I don't think government is the right answer to this, because all you're doing then is trading one political standard for misinformation for another political standard for misinformation. I believe in free speech. I believe that you listen to all sides and then you go back to the data to see if it's true. The problem is, in many cases, the American people, including those running these companies, they don't bother going back to see if what they're told is true. And again, I'm not just picking on big tech. You see the same thing with pharmaceutical companies, with many major corporations, even small businesses. They're not looking to see if what they're being told is true. They're just listening to a source that they agree with, maybe trust, and then running forward with it. Now, the only reason Twitter's being brought up on this is because they have such a far reach. They impact so many people, and they've been found to be so blatantly wrong, not just on COVID, by the way. We did the same thing with the Hunter Biden report, the same thing with the Russian collusion reports. These are all situations where people say, you shouldn't be allowed to contradict our narrative because that information is dangerous. It's necessary that we control what you say because you may say something that we don't like. They say that it's so that we don't say something that's wrong, but let's face it, it's not based on facts or data or science. It's based on policy. And this is the danger of these calls to censor misinformation. It's why we have freedom of speech protected in both the U.S. Constitution and in each and every one of our state constitutions. We used to relish the debate. I'm old enough to remember when we used to say, I may vehemently disagree with what you had to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. That is how we find out what the truth really is. But today, They're saying it's necessary that you be hidden from that information because you may make a decision that we don't like. Now, there's one more area I want you to consider here. You see, the U.S. Senate recently voted to ratify what's called the Kigali Amendment. It's part of what was called the Montreal Protocol. And the basic idea is this amendment wants to control, to regulate participating countries to get them to cut their hydrofluorocarbon emissions. I remember those bad HFCs. They were supposedly destroying the ozone and all that fun and games. Now, what bothers me is, rather than making a decision based on what's best for the American people, the Obama administration first negotiated. Now the Senate has apparently ratified this amendment that basically gives the UN theoretically the ability to tell the American people how to live their lives. Now, I'm reading a lot of people who are saying, you know, this is it subverts American sovereignty, that we're going to become, we've given up our sovereignty to the UN. And I can understand that, except for one little thing. It's called the Supremacy Clause. See, many people remember the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. The Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Clause 2, says this Constitution and the laws of the United States made pursuant thereof, and or thereto, and I talk about that a lot, but also says treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States. Well, where does the United States get its authority? The Constitution. Meaning, if the Constitution does not authorize the federal government to regulate things like, hydrofluorocarbons, signing a treaty doesn't give them that power either. It is, as if I can paraphrase Marbury versus Madison, if a act of the legislature contrary to the Constitution or repugnant to the Constitution is void, wouldn't a treaty repugnant to the Constitution also be void? Otherwise, you'd basically say the federal government could do through treaty what it's not allowed to do by law. And that just doesn't make sense. The problem is most people don't realize that. Why? Well, because we don't read and study our Constitution. Most people think that once a treaty is signed, that's it. Well, guess what? If it's not under the authority of the United States to do it, that treaty doesn't suddenly give the United States more power, even if it's trying to fulfill a treaty that it signed. See, it's our ignorance and the ignorance of our legal profession and of our representatives that has led us to this sorry state, a sorry state where the opinion, the policy of an administration, now what, more than 8 years Well, no, 4 years gone, 6 years gone, that the policies of a single administration are deemed to be the necessity that allows them to infringe on your rights, to ignore the Constitution, to do what we've forbidden them to do. How do we fix this? Again, the first step is the same no matter what. It's to read and study the Constitution and teach the rising generation to be free. Well, how do you do that? Well, there are plenty of ways of doing that. Again, I have a whole website, Constitution Study, dedicated to helping people learn and read and study. And in fact, the sister website, ConstitutionScholars.com, is where people come together to be students of the Constitution. And they're all there for you to use, for you to share, and to help you read and study the Constitution. I added what I call my planning wizard. So if you go to ConstitutionStudy.com and you look for wizard, you answer a few questions, and then the system will generate emails to you letting you know, well, have you considered this? Have you tried this to help you read and study so you can better understand the Constitution? I'm planning probably either late this year, maybe after the holidays, to start up another online Constitution study so that more people can join us and read and study the Constitution together as a group. But we do it online, so we don't have to travel everywhere. Now, the other thing we want to do is we want to focus locally. You want to make sure that your neighbors, your sheriff, your county commissions, that they are aware of their responsibilities by the oath they take to support the Constitution and make sure they're enforcing them. Then, from there, we can work on our states. And from there, well, Washington, D.C. kind of takes care of itself. So there, I want to leave you with a little bit of hope. There are possibilities. But we need to stop looking for other people to protect our rights. We need to stop simply blaming other people for the actions we have let them take, for the necessity we have let them foist upon us. If we wish to be free, if we the people wish to be free, we the people who ordained and established the Constitution must be the masters of all of our governments at all levels. Now, if you like this show and you want to share it with others, well, you can let them know that weekdays, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, they can listen to the Constitution Study on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network. We've got a media player you can watch through your web browser, or we have after Apple, Android, and Alexa. Now, most of my shows go to podcasts generally a day or two after they're heard on the radio. Now, you can find them on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, iHeart Podcast, basically anywhere you listen to podcasts. And by the way, there are two Constitution Study podcasts, both of which are mine. You've got the one for the Constitution Study website, which is once a week, and you got the daily one from America Out Loud. And you can find all the links for the America Out Loud shows at AmericaOutLoud.com. Do me a favor, share them. Only together can we, working together, share the blessings of liberty in this great country from sea to shining sea.